This is tape number one, the morning of December the 8th, 1960. The President, Noyes, Hillman. Mr. President, we're getting to Mr. Polk.
One of your favorite presidents and one of your esteemed ones.
James K. Polk. He really was a great man. But it took a long time for people to find out just exactly what he did.
Why was that, Mr. President?
Oh, well, the usual thing in that period, that compromise, which was progressing toward the Civil War, it was an effort on the part of everybody to make it appear that Polk was not doing what he should have done. But I think he did what he should have done, and he did it in a four-year period under the statement that he would carry out his program and quit, which he did, and he went home and died.
Well, now, actually, Polk was credited with being responsible for the greatest expansion of American territory in our entire history. How did that come about?
Except the American Revolution, except the purchase of the Louisiana territory. It was a couple of hundred or a thousand square miles smaller than Louisiana territory, but Polk paid the same price for it that Jefferson did for the Louisiana purchase.
And what was that? What do you mean by that?
$15 million.
Right.
Well, but it wasn't as good as the purchase for Louisiana for the simple reason that Missouri was not in the program.
Well, now, Polk was active in provoking or launching a war against Mexico, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. The war against Mexico was organized by the people in Texas. And Polk had to meet the situation or lose Texas. And so he met it.
Well, there was a territorial problem involved as to the southern border of Texas. It was the Nueces River as against the
Rio Grande.
Rio Grande.
That's right.
And Mexico claimed that territory, and Texas claimed that it had it, and Polk recognized
Texas
going all the way to there.
That's all of us to.
Now, what were the underlying problems there in connection with the annexation of Texas and Polk's intervention in that?
3630, the southern boundary of Missouri. And when that situation was recognized by Polk, and Texas was admitted with the agreement that they could be five states instead of one, that was to meet the situation with which the country was then faced. And then Polk, when the Mexican War was on, decided that the best thing to do was to take the southern boundary of the United States all the way to the Pacific Ocean. That's what he did.
Now, Polk was an expansionist and supposed to be a militant expansionist, and he had a lot of trouble with the Whigs during his presidency.
Every good American president has always been an expansionist.
In that connection, I'd like to read just a short paragraph, because that's very pertinent at that time, of question of manifest destiny or imperialism.
I never believed in manifest destiny, but go ahead.
It says, imperialism implies the conquest of colonial people who would then be kept in a state of permanent subservience to the mother country. But manifest destiny, on the other hand, by, according to the proponents, proposed the annexation of adjacent territories elevated to a point where they could enjoy the point.
That's what happened, both in Louisiana and in the Polk program, which took all the southwest part of the.
Why do you say you don't believe in manifest destiny as such?
Oh, well, manifest destiny is a period of that time.
West side,
and the southwest part of the country, where the idea that the people would have the same privileges that they had in the other part of the country. And I don't with that. That's a little frame. That's good.
Well, we send John Slidell to Mexico to try to negotiate with Mexico to assume the claims against the Mexican government and
that's
all
right.
That.
That's right.
Says he decided on war as soon as he heard of the Slidell's failure. In other words, the government wouldn't deal, the Mexican government wouldn't deal with Slidell.
That's right.
And in the hopes of provoking Mexico into striking the first blow, he sent troops under Zachary Taylor into the disputed region.
But you're west of the Peck Shredder.
But by May 9th, 1846, the president was so tired of waiting that he told his cabinet to declaration of war on the basis of Mexico's refusal to meet its international obligation. Before this message was sent, news reached Washington, news reached the army. Pope redrafted his message, claiming that war was justified by Mexico's invasion war on May 12, 1846.
That's true. That's right.
Well, we were involved with
that's right.
Well, we were involved with Santa Anna at that time, who was a brigand and a was a brigand and a was a brigand and a brigand and a wasn't he?
Well, he was Mexican. The Mexicans liked and liked and liked, and I can't agree with the fact that he was organizing his people for the defense of his country, and I think he had a right.
When he was captured, we delivered him or got him back into Mexico, didn't we?
That's right.
And he made a deal of his liberation.
Right to make, that's what the trouble was.
Could you tell us a little bit more about it? Because that's a little bit more about it, because that's very important about it, because that's a
We had a divided country on the Mexican War. The North was actually
arguing against it.
Yes, they were, because they were afraid that the territory would increase the number of slaves, It did, of course. But
that situation
overcome.
When
the war between the states took place. But I don't think that Pope had any idea of causing a war between the states. What he wanted to do was to extend the Republic of the United States to the Pacific Ocean in the Southwest. And that's what he did. And that's the most important thing that happened.
Just one question there that seems to be an intriguing reference into the motives of Pope that has in the main battle defeated armies under Santa Anna, he feared that Taylor's increasing popularity until the northern provinces were subdued.
Both Taylor and
Scott
were Whigs. And both of them accomplished his, but old man Scott didn't. But he ran in 52 when Franklin Pierce was elected.
What was in your mind, Mr. President, when you stopped off at Chapultepec, where Chapultepec was about at the
friendship with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of State asked me if I would be willing on the monument to the hero, Minochad, the hero. I didn't say the reason.
Arizona,
New Mexico, New Utah, or which Kent K. Pope paid $15 million.
Yeah, but the Mexicans didn't want the United States to have it, of course. And Britain filed out of the deal.
Russia was also in the picture.
Because Lincoln, who was then in the congressman, and he called it a very dirty business.
That he was the most unconstitutional president we ever had after he got there.
The press of that time were also assaulting Polk. Now, one of the Whig newspapers went so far as to
suggest that all the soldiers under Polk and Scott were thrown into the ocean and got rid of them.
Say the same thing about Korea a little later on.
This is important because what was this part of the anti-colonialism, or were they? What was bothering them?
No. The thing that was bothering him was the fear that the accumulation of territory in the Southwest would make the Northeast less powerful. That's all there was in connection with it.
Too much of a spread, watered down their authority.
No,
their influence.
They thought that that would happen, and it did. And a good thing that it did.
Yeah. Well, now, Mr. President, Dave, he was a man who knew
what he wanted to do, and he did it. He was an and very seldom seen.
Could you develop that a little, Mr. President?
Well, he made up his mind what he wanted to do, and he went ahead and did it. And when he got through with it, he went home. And 3 months after he got out of the White House, he died.
Well, now, he started out with the commitment that he would only
serve one term. Then he put his program over in that one term, and then went home, retired, and in June he died after his retirement on March 4th.
Now, he said a very very moving thing upon his retirement, that he now, I now retire as a servant and regain my position as a sovereign.
He was right, absolutely right. I've been through it, and I know.
Now, would you go a little deeper into the personality of Polk? Because he was supposed to be the first of our dark horse presidents to be elected.
Well, that's silly. He had been Speaker of the House. He'd been a member of the House. Everybody knew who he was. And he wasn't such a dark horse. He was the compromise candidate. And the reason they called him the first dark horse was because he wasn't considered to begin with.
This is the end of tape one, the morning of December the 7th. Correction on that. The date is December the 8th, 1960. Tape number, the morning of December the 8th, 1960. Go ahead, Mr. President.
Well, you were having some idea of what the state of Polk's election and what we were thinking about, what we were hoping, and what our problems were.
Well, the state of the nation was a peculiar one because there had been all sorts of troubles with the southern states and the northern states as to the control of the Senate. And so when Polk came along, there was difficulty with regard to Texas and the southwest part of the United States. And Polk met the situation by deciding that it was the best thing for the country if the whole southwest corner of the United States could be made a part of the nation. And after the Mexican War, he paid Mexico the same price for that part of the country that Jefferson had paid for the Louisiana Purchase, and he was perfectly right in doing it. And for that reason, the states of Arizona, New Mexico, California, and part of Utah, and part of Texas are now states in the Union, and And of course, nobody can find fault with that arrangement at the present time.
Actually, they were not heavily populated by Mexicans in any of those territories.
No, they weren't. No, they weren't.
Only a handful of them in California and very few in Arizona and New Mexico.
Well, and of course, the Western Trek was taking place. And after the Civil War, that trek took place in a great many ways. It finally wound up in the states of New Mexico, Arizona, and California.
And you're suggesting that Polk suited that particular period exactly as the right kind of president for the job.
There's no doubt about it.
Now, what were the how does that kind of thing develop? What were the people looking for in a president at that time? What was needed?
Well, what was needed was a man who was strong enough to meet the situation and carry through a program which he thought was right, and that's what Polk did.
Well, what was really troubling the people other than wanting to get more territory?
Abolitionists and the situation as regards slavery in the South, which was always wrong, the slavery part of it was, but the abolitionists were just like the integrationists today. They wanted to do everything all at once, which took a common sense approach to get done.
Are you trying to say that the South at that time was beginning to reconcile itself to the ultimate abolition of slavery?
There isn't any doubt about it. There isn't any doubt about it. If you read the history of the various Southern states, you find time after time where when great slave owners died, they freed their slaves. And it was never proper for the South to have slaves, but it was brought about by the commercial interests in Massachusetts who were in the slave trade from Africa to the
South.
Africa, created the situation more than anybody else.
You mean they actually did the transporting of slaves?
They had transported the slaves and sold them to the South after it was against the law to sell them.
So the slave difficulty was really up when the
war was in both parts of the country, and so and it took a war to settle it, and that's what brought it about.
Well, now, in the contest between Tyler and Polk, Tyler is supposed to have been on all sides of all questions during that campaign and tried to get on the Polk side on the slave issue, and declared himself as accepting the fact that the question of slavery is not a question of being for it or against it, but a question of or against it.
That's true. And that's the way it grew. And that's the way it grew. And that's the way most of the leaders in the South felt. But the propagandists and the people who were affected by the situation brought about the war between the states.
Well, the Constitution introduced and passed by the Congress, but not affirmed by the Senate, by a fat congressman from Pennsylvania who put in that rider.
What the?
Call it a resolution, and call it which he acquired, where slavery is to be
gazetted, purchased.
That's right.
Gets and purchase.
Now, to get at the
Wilmot was that proviso.
Wilmot proviso,
but Wilmot and purchase was the result of the Wilmot proviso.
Before I get to that, Dave, I'd like to ask one question. Before the slave trade was ended, in this period that I'm talking about,
it was supposed to be ended in 18. By a resolution which Jefferson got through the Constitutional Convention, but it wasn't.
That's international slave trade.
International slave trade.
It didn't.
No, it didn't.
A compromise or a surrender by you.
Well,
surrendered by you.
No, no. That's all the trouble was. Just like you can't get things done now in the Congress.
So they've got
now coming up. A reorganization of the National Defense Program, which was a way to begin with way to heaven. They'll have the same trouble reorganizing that happened when the organization was trying to be set up at the time in the beginning, when the combination of the three armed services was put together.
Well, it was showing up during the Polk administration that the Whigs in the Congress were true to their tradition of opposing any measure that involved hostilities. They simply did not want to encourage or approve any appropriations that involved war.
Especially if that war was against their program, which was to make the country free instead of slave. That's all that was involved.
And may I ask this basic question? In a certain sense, then, political parties, rather than helping carry out the process of government, at times make it more difficult and create problems.
That's right. And you've got to have a leader with ability and strength to work out the welfare of the country in spite of what any party wants to do for its backward look.
And that political parties often represent sectional or certain special interests rather than...
They have to.
Well, in this case...
I don't want to pay too much attention to that.
Well, now, in this case, the Whigs apparently were perfectly willing to vote a lot of money for supplies that involved business, but didn't want to vote a lot of money for men or for armaments.
Well, just like it is today. The Republicans are just Whigs over again.
Well, now, there's been a constant barrage of the Nixon variety, in quotes, that Democrats always made war and Republicans always kept the peace. Now.
No, that's just a political nothing but political conversation. Whenever it was necessary for the country to go to war, how the Spanish
American come out
are to be met. And you find that's true. Why did the war between the states take place? Because Lincoln wanted to preserve the Union. And then, I don't know, situation develops, but there isn't any difference in which political organization is in control of the White House. The president has to make up his mind and decide what he wants.
Polk is among the great presidents, and yet
he had not only his general troubles, but he also had his troubles.
Every president always leads the country, always has his troubles. If he's strong president, always has troubles with the Congress, making a difference whether it's a war loan or not.
Well, now, isn't that an impediment in time of democracy? Isn't that a drag on the president and doesn't come and a drawback to the democratic process, back to the government and a draw time of emergency?
No, I don't think so. Whenever the president knows what he's doing, he can always convince his ideas. Really never has any real trouble with the Congress if he wants to overcome Congress.
How did Polk go about convincing the Congress
and told them what he wanted to do, just as every war president did. And we'll have to continue.
Whenever there is an emergency, tell them what the situation is,
and why certain things have to be done
in a reasonable manner.
They wouldn't be there.
Well, the president
sent some awfully unreasonable and stubborn and willful men in the Congress.
Yes, but they didn't have control, thank goodness. The majority of the Congress are made up of men who are elected for a certain purpose, and they're reasonable men. The stubborn men in the Congress are a natural corollary of free government. And when the President of the United States makes up his mind that he wants to do something, he can always convince a majority of the Congress that he's right. And when he does, the stubborn men don't count.
Therefore, you think that many of the great problems which presidents have had have been due to their inability to see clearly what they wanted.
That's true. And their inability to understand that the human animal can be convinced of right when it is right. And they didn't make the effort to convince it.
In other words, you believe in a political philosophy that reason can convince reasonable men.
I don't think so.
I think you're making another point, that he also has to have a clear mind and be entirely sound about what he's out to do.
He has to know where he's going and why he's going there, and he's got to be able to explain it.
Well, there's a difference between having a clear mind of what he wants to do and whether he has a reasonable ground to go ahead. Supposing a president is very firm in his belief a certain course is right, and yet he may be taking the wrong turn.
Well, if he's a man of good sense, he listens to the arguments. And if he finds that he's wrong, he'll go ahead on the other direction, in the other direction. And that's merely a matter of laying the plans on the table and letting everybody have his say. And you find that most presidents have been well informed and are convinced that the programs which they want to follow are correct. And when they find that they're not, then they're willing to be convinced that something else ought to be done.
Now, one of the things about Polk that seems to stand out is that he was perhaps the most hardworking president up to his time that's occupied that office.
I don't think so at all about that.
And that he actually had to forego some of the things that you've often pointed out as one of the most troublesome jobs of a president, which is the ceremonial part of the job, which is the social part. Now, he completely turned his back on the social part of the presidency, didn't he?
Well, he was living in an age when the terrific burdens of making decisions in a war were entirely in the hands of the president. And when that came about, he decided that that was much more important than going to parties and shaking hands with people. And I know exactly how he felt. But in my time, there were more able and consistent people, more able and informed people who were helping the president at that time. And that made a difference.
That's the end of tape 2 of the morning of December the 8th.